Welcome to the School of Batman, a podcast where we ask academics to help Batman fight crime using their research. I'm your host, Chris George, amateur scientist and professional Batman enthusiast. In today's episode, we'll be discussing the Birdman of Gotham. We're pleased to be joined by Dr. Alex Evans, who has a PhD in biology studying animal locomotion from the University of Leeds. Alex also writes about bird research in his blog, Bird Brained Science. So hi Alex, welcome to the show and thanks for joining us. How are you today?
I'm very good, thanks. It's lovely to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So yeah, let's dig into a little bit about your research, how you got to where you are today, what some of your interests were, your path to where you are, what your current working environment is like, and how you go about your research, and some stuff about your blog maybe. So yeah, just start with telling us a little bit about what you do.
So I recently finished my PhD in animal locomotion, but I originally started off doing a zoology degree at the University of Leeds, and I knew I really liked to learn about animals, so I did a master's also at the University of Leeds in biodiversity and conservation, which featured a lot more practical skills, but also building on my knowledge base of animals around the world. And then from here, I realized I really liked birds, bird ecology, bird behavior, bird physiology. And so I decided I wanted to pursue a PhD in bird science. And one that popped up just so happened to be, again, at the University of Leeds. And so for the last 4.5 years, I've been studying how birds fly, how insects fly, also just how animals move around in general.
So animal locomotion, does that just mean the study of animal movement?
Basically, yes. Mostly it tends to do with the biomechanics, the actual movement of the body to get the animal through its environment. But you can also look at it from a wider angle and tie it into ecology, how animals get around different types of landscapes in order to feed or migrate or reproduce.
Right, and so is the research you're doing, is that in a way kind of trying to understand how these things work, or is there any application to it, any applied work from it as well?
So a lot of ecologists and ecophysiologists who work with birds in the wild want to understand how much it costs to do certain flight activities, such as seabirds foraging out to sea, or birds flying between continents during their annual migration. And it's quite difficult to work out how costly these trips are. In the past, equations and predictive models have been used, but these rely on untested assumptions about various aspects of bird energetics. And so a lot of my work is trying to fill in these knowledge gaps in order to produce better predictive models, so ecophysiologists can have a more confident understanding of how much it costs to do these flight behaviours.
So when you're talking about costs there, we're not talking about a bird going and buying a budget airline kind of flight to get somewhere. So what do we mean by costs?
So when we're going about our everyday life, we need chemical energy in the form of food to fuel our body. Not only our muscles that move our limbs, but also we need to keep our heart going to pump blood around our body. And all of these processes come with an energetic cost. So when I talk about costs of flight, I'm mostly talking about the energy requirements to move the major flight muscles, the pectoralis. So for birds, the pectoralis takes up, depending on the species, about a 15 to 20% of the body mass, which compared to humans is a lot, but obviously we don't have to flap our arms all the time like birds do. And so during flight, these muscles require a lot of energy, but how much exactly, it's very hard to tell.
Right, so let's dig into that a little bit more. How on earth do you even start going to approximate some of these costs? Where do you begin, and what does a kind of practical day-to-day reality of your research look like?
So one way to come at assessing the costs of flight is from an aerodynamic angle, and this constituted the bulk of the research about 50 years ago. However, with more modern technology, we can fly birds in a wind tunnel, which is what I've done during my PhD, and we can measure various aspects of their flight, be it we can look at the kinematics, so we can film them and work out what the joints are doing inside the body, how the wings are moving. This will lead into the aerodynamics, so we can use particle image velocimetry, which is basically we put loads of small particles like dust into the wind tunnel, and we were able to see how they move around a bird's wing and the forces that are produced from that. Or we can come at it from an energetics point of view, so we can use respirometry. And this is where you measure the oxygen consumption and the CO2 production of a bird during flight, and this gas exchange is intrinsically linked to the energy consumption that's going on inside the body. So you're able to work out roughly the metabolic rate or the metabolic costs going on during flight. And so my PhD aimed to use different techniques like this to try and create a more unified understanding of animal flight.
So I think everybody is familiar with the idea of what a wind tunnel or an air tunnel looks like with cars and planes and things like that. Is it literally the same kind of idea, but instead of a car or plane, you have a captured, like, tame bird or something that you put in it?
Essentially, yes. I mean, the working section is obviously a lot smaller than you'd have for a plane or a car. The birds I work with tend to be parrots because they're quite friendly, they're quite easy to train, and they can be quite small, so they can fit in the wind tunnel quite easily. And over my PhD, I found parrots a pleasure to work with most of the time.
Right, and how do you capture things like that gas exchange? Do they have... the only thing I can think of is high-end athletes who have various different masks and things on when they're doing exercise to capture this kind of gas exchange. Do you have very tiny little masks that you put on a parrot, or is it something more complex with analysing the environment of the wind tunnel and capturing these minute changes?
No, you got it. I spent a good portion of my PhD designing small little masks for our parrots to wear. It only takes, I'd say, 15, 20 minutes for them to get used. I mean, obviously, first, they have no idea what we're doing, putting these masks on them. But after 15, 20 minutes, they realise it's not painful. It's not restricting them really in any way. It's essentially just collecting the gas that comes into the mask and then the gas that goes out.
Did you only work with parrots, or did you start to look at other species as well?
We mainly just worked with parrots, so cockatiels and budgies are quite common in this sort of area of research. A lot of work has been done on both them as a whole animal, and also a lot of work has been done on their muscles to work out how much power they can generate under controlled conditions. But a lot of work has been done on larger birds, so corvids, such as crows, for example. They're also quite clever and easy to train. Whereas if you're working with small songbirds, for example, or birds that don't necessarily have the cognitive abilities that parrots and corvids do, training them can be a lot more difficult.
Okay, so how much of a... I'm not sure, 100% sure of the word I'm looking for, but how reasonable an example is a parrot or a budgie to extrapolate out across other birds? Like, how can you say that the costs that a parrot or budgie are experiencing are comparable, or you can say that larger birds will be 10%, 20% more? How do you go about that process?
So that's a very good question. So there is definitely an aspect of body mass scaling in terms of the metabolic costs of flight. So the smaller you are, relatively higher the costs of flight will be. The bigger you get, obviously the absolute costs will be larger, but per unit of body mass, the relative costs will be smaller. And there's a few reasons for this. Smaller birds, such as hummingbirds and small songbirds, will flap their wings with a much higher wing beat. So hummingbirds will flap their wings 50 times a second more if they're hovering. Whereas if you look at larger birds, such as geese, you're looking at much lower, definitely less than 10 times a second, closer to 5 times a second. And this is mainly they have bigger wings. They're able to generate more of the lift they need without flapping their wings. So you're right in thinking that extrapolating from a small bird to a large bird is difficult. So not only will their wing beat frequency change, but also the gait of their flight. So as we may walk or run, birds also have different types of flight style to suit the requirements of what they need in the moment. So some birds will flap for a while, and then they'll glide, and then they'll flap. Whereas other birds will just flap consistently without taking any sort of intermediate breaks. And so extrapolating the cost of flight between these two different styles can be difficult. So yeah, we do have to be careful there.
Hey, so on that, I think it's probably time for us to move to your story. So we like to ask our guests to choose a Batman actor to represent their Batman in their story. And have you chosen one?
I have. So I'm a big fan of Kevin Conroy, the actor that voiced Batman in the animated shows and movies and the Arkham games. I feel he has a good mixture of confidence and integrity and also humour, and he represents the Batman I enjoy most. And I actually have a signed Kevin Conroy animated Batman print hanging next to my bed that I got as a wedding present from some friends.
Wonderful. Say goodnight before you go to bed every night. Lovely. The foreboding silhouette of the Batman swooping across the grey skies of Gotham is enough to strike fear into the hearts of even the most hardened career criminals. But as always, for Bruce, he can improve. Frustrated with the limited gliding abilities of the Batsuit, he once again looks to nature in an attempt to stay watchful from the skies as quietly and as long as possible. So this seems like something your research will absolutely be able to help with. So Batman, as we know, he kind of glides and swoops, but he uses less mechanical and more kind of organic methods of gliding. So we were talking about the idea of some of these extrapolating out to bigger things, bigger birds, and Batman is probably one of the biggest birds you could imagine. So how might you approach helping the Batman in this situation?
So gliding is definitely one thing, and creating self-sustaining flapping flight is an entirely different game. First off, it wouldn't be easy or cheap, but we are talking about Batman here, so we'll just assume that's no problem. In terms of generating flapping flight, the main problem to overcome will be the weight of Batman. So not only is he quite a big man, he may also be wearing armor and gadgets, and realistically, as his cape is as it is, there's probably very little chance he would be able to glide with that. It's more likely he might drop from a great height, slowed down slightly, but he will end up as a bat splat, I imagine, quite quickly. So in terms of overcoming this weight, what he could do is have much bigger wings. So based on what I know about bird wings, it would have to be a lot longer than his body length. Which is problematic.
Maybe if we could have some kind of technique of being able to unfurl these very large bat wings falling from the skies as he goes, would that be something that would help him overcome that?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, there are a lot of cool materials in the bat universe. I'm sure he'd have something that was both strong, durable, but also light and flexible enough that would be able to constitute the bulk of the wings, and hopefully then have some sort of membrane or even some feather-based analog that he could use to create the majority of the wing surface.
So I want to just go back to the thing you said at the beginning. That was quite interesting, the idea about the worlds apart difference between working on gliding and working on kind of self-sustaining flapping flight.
Yeah.
So obviously birds and things can take off from the ground or from a static start, and is that purely the kind of weight to pectoral to wing ratio that enables them to do that, or is there something more special going on? I guess the question I'm asking for is, like, if a human had that kind of 15% to 20% pectoral ratio and the appropriate wings, is there anything stopping them there, any further impediments?
Definitely. So in terms of as a percentage ratio, the muscle mass, even if we, so I think I worked it out as if we had a similar pectoral ratio, it would be like attaching a bowling ball to our chest. Even if we had that, we would then still need even bigger wings, which would then even add even more weight. And in terms of Batman, I don't think there's any way he would be able to generate enough power from his muscles to move his arms fast enough. I think for Batman, the best option would be some sort of external wing attachment. So he can keep his arms free, which is good. He's got plenty of gadgets he can still use. But it'd have to be something, some pair of wings he attached to his back that were powered by some electronically controlled motor, which unfortunately would also add weight. So I can imagine, whilst these wings might be able to unfurl and be stored away, when they're unfurled, they will be ginormous.
So let's go back to the gliding then, I guess. So let's just talk a little bit about the kind of movie gliding as we know now and as we see. I think maybe like the Nolan films have done some particularly impressive gliding visuals, and certainly back to 1989. Based on what you're seeing with the wing size and ratio, is that wildly impractical, what we're seeing, if that was going to be something that was done in reality, or is it actually pretty close to facilitate real gliding?
If you look at sort of base jumpers or people who have wingsuits, when they're gliding, it's more they're moving downwards, but they're able to move forwards in whatever direction they like. And I think Batman would be more similar to that. He would be falling very fast, but would have some degree over which direction he was falling. So in the films, we may see him flying forwards. And I think that would probably be quite unlikely with what he's got. There was actually a study done by some students at the University of Leicester where they used aerodynamic calculations to try and work out if these sorts of Batman capes would work. And I think they worked out that jumping from a certain height, Batman would be able to glide for a certain distance, but by the time he touched the ground, he would be going about 60 miles an hour. And so, unless he had some sort of springs on his shoes, then his legs would not be in a good state.
Okay, so we're going to need to bring someone else in to help with the landing. But whilst he's in the air, you were saying about some different materials and different things, and possibly using kind of some kind of feather type arrangement. If you were going to be making Batman's cape, and obviously difficulty and money was no object, how would you approach it? What would some of the tests and things that you would do to try and get the optimum maneuverability and speed and things like that?
So, I mean, it's a very good question. I think the approach I would take is similar to what I've been doing with my PhD research. I would build a wind tunnel. I'm sure Batman has plenty of room in his cave for that. And I would design different types of wings and stick them in the wind tunnel and see how much lift they could generate and how big they needed to be to generate the lift to keep Batman airborne. If you have some sort of motorized arm, you can also move the wing inside the wind tunnel and you'd be able to identify the aerodynamic forces going on and try and work out how much power you're able to produce. And the key thing is generating this mechanical power, which will exert force onto the air and keep Batman moving forwards.
So we also talked a little bit before the show started about some of the other work you've done around formation flight and drones, and that sounds very applicable to Batman and helping him fight crime. So could you tell us a little bit about some of that?
Yeah, certainly. So I'm very interested in the concept of formation flight, mostly to do with birds, but more recently it has been extrapolated into the use for communication and optimal flying patterns for energy saving with autonomous unmanned aerial vehicles, such as small drones. In terms of flapping flight, small flapping robots are called ornithopters. And I'd like to see Batman utilize ornithopters more. So I think it'd be quite easy for him to design a small fleet of robotic bats or robotic birds that mimic the flight of bats and birds, and be able to get these flying in some sort of formation that saves energy and allows them to communicate with each other. And I think, if anything, that's probably a lot more likely than Batman being able to self-sustain flight around the streets of Gotham. So if he's thinking practically, formation flying bat bots may be the way to go.
Right, so why is there a difference between one, I mean, that's, I've just learnt that word for the first time actually, so I'm very much enjoying it. Why is there a difference between one ornithopter flying and many ornithopters flying? Why are the energy costs decreased when you get into a formation?
So when a bird flaps its wings, it's generating vortices of air that move off the edge of the wings, and as the bird travels forwards, these are just left behind in the wake. And obviously, if a bird's flying in formation, there will be another bird moving through that bird's wake. And depending on where that bird's wing is in relation to the vortex, it'll either be able to gain some lift, or if it's in the wrong position, it'll be pushed downwards. There was a recent study a few years ago that looked at how birds, in this case it was ibises, how they were flying in formation and how their wings were beating in relation to each other. And they identified that these birds were timing their wing beats just so as the vortex was traveling upwards, the bird behind would be flying with its wing stretched out during that very particular phase of the wing beat cycle, and would then be gaining some lift benefit from the wake of the bird in front. Of course, if you then reproduce this, so you've got not just a couple of birds flying, but if you have more and more birds flying, then all of these birds are gaining this benefit. So overall, you're saving a lot of energy compared to just having birds flying in a random distribution, where in fact they may even be at risk of colliding with each other, or flying in the downwash of each other's wing beats, which would be even more energetically expensive.
So does that compound upon itself as it kind of goes down the chain? Is like the last bird in the series receiving not only the benefit of the bird ahead, but also the bird ahead and the bird ahead and the bird ahead? Or is there a critical limit?
So theoretical work that's been done suggests that overall, for all the birds, you to get the best benefit, you want an infinite number of birds. So it does tend to be more birds, bigger savings overall. But with the distance behind the bird, the energy you gain from the vortex diminishes quite rapidly. So any bird flying behind another bird is likely to get a big benefit. Any bird behind that, it may not really have any effect. This is one of the things we're not really sure about how much of an effect this might have. No one has yet quantified exactly these energetic savings. We just know they're flying in a way that would save energy. But yeah, in terms of how much of a saving, we're not yet quite sure.
Yeah, so I guess that was going to be my next question almost, was when you look at these formations in nature, do you see evidence of like an optimal number of animals within a formation that kind of supports some of these theories, or is that distribution fairly random along the chain? For example, you're saying where this drops off as it kind of falls down, and it's really only the benefit of maybe the bird or two in front. Do you see smaller formations to maximize benefit, or do you see big flocks where maybe it's not only considering the energy benefits of flying in formation, but there may be more social or other aspects, because see, there's many different dimensions when it comes to what animal behavior actually means and why it occurs. So do you see that kind of thing where you'll see optimal formations based on the pure aerodynamics, or are there other factors in play, I guess?
So the overwhelming consensus is that these birds are flying to save energy, and you do see that even the bird flying in front theoretically should gain some energy saving, even though that bird's not flying in the wake of another bird. It should be gaining some upwash from the birds immediately behind it. So overall, the energy saving does seem to be the best hypothesis. But there is evidence suggesting they do get communications benefits as well. If you're flying behind one bird that you can see very well, you just need to know what they're doing. Same for the bird then, in front. They just have to be focused on what one bird is doing, rather than keeping an eye on an entire flock. Whereas in pigeons, you may see big groups flying off together, and for them, communication is key and can be quite complicated because there's a lot of birds to keep track of. Whereas in formation flights, like the flying V we see in geese, this is a lot more streamlined and a lot easier to manage. There's also, as you mentioned, a social aspect. So there's been research done on which birds fly in which positions, and you do tend to see that birds flying at the front of a V will be the older, more experienced birds who maybe are leading the way. But there's evidence to suggest that when birds get tired in the leading position, if they haven't saved as much energy as the rest, they will drop out of the front and another bird will then take over. So it's not just staying in one formation. They will move and change position so everyone gets to share these benefits.
Right. So if we were looking at like an optimistic future for things like drones and ornithopters and things like that, you could imagine big fleets of delivery vehicles or things like that all being able to take advantage of this principle. Is this only for things like ornithopters, or is the same principle applied to what in my mind a drone is, with the little copters and things like that? Do the same benefits apply there?
So not in the same way. So the theoretical basis behind this formation flight is largely to do with the flapping of the wings and the generation of these vortices. And I'm not sure how that would be interpreted when using something that maybe flies like a helicopter.
So noise and stealthiness is a huge thing for the Batman. He needs to be able to get to where he needs to go in the quietest way possible. Now, do different types of wings, materials, things like that generate different noise levels? Is there anything that we can do to help him here be more stealthy?
Yes, absolutely. So I know the Batman's not a particular fan of owls, but they are a great example to go to when you're trying to minimize the noise you make during flight. So owl wings, they have special structures on their feathers which break up the air moving over the wing, which helps to reduce noise. And they also have very soft, fluffy feathers which help to absorb the sound as well. So if you've ever seen an owl in a zoo or even in the wild, they fly absolutely silently, and it's quite bizarre when you see. But obviously this helps them descend on their prey in the night, dropping down on an unsuspecting mouse and just plucking them right out of the air. So I think for Batman, traveling along using something like the owl as a basis for his wing design is probably a good idea.
And is it more expensive to generate that kind of flight, either in the growth of the feathers or how they fly, or is it just that is, for an owl, the optimum way of getting their prey, and that's why they've kind of evolved in that way?
There'll definitely be a cost benefit to having wings like this. So the extra structures on the wings, whilst they break up the airflow, they probably add some level of drag to the bird, which will slow them down, and they'll have to generate more power to maintain the flight speed they want. Same with the feathers, that's probably going to add some level of drag or extra weight to the bird, so there'll be a cost there. But if those adaptations allow them to get a lot more food, then in the long run it's worth it. If they can get a mouse compared to a bird that doesn't have these adaptations, then yes, absolutely, it's worth having these extra wing structures.
That's all for today. Thanks to Alex for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And if you'd like to find out more about Alex's work, you can follow him on Twitter at AlexEvans91. And we've also got a link to his blog in the description of the episode. If you'd like to be a future guest on the podcast, please email us at info@figshare.com. And you can find us on Twitter at School of Batman.